Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and thank you for joining me on another episode of Living History. It's great to be back. I hope you're enjoying the episodes we've been bringing you lately in this recent series, which includes some absolutely incredible historians talking about fascinating chapters of history. And today is certainly no exception. Recently, I was in London and I was fortunate to go to the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, an absolutely brilliant museum. If you haven't been there, I suggest you go and check it out. And while I was there, I met with Dr. Robert Blythe, who is a senior curator, and we spent a couple of hours talking about the Battle of Trafalgar, Nelson's huge victory in 1805 against the French and the Spanish. And while we were there, he took me through the absolutely sensational collection of artifacts that the museum has associated with the Battle of Trafalgar, and we were able to paint an incredible picture just by looking at six items from the Battle of Trafalgar. It was a really special visit. They've got some incredible items, and items which really tell the story of the Battle of Trafalgar in a very special way. Now, like always when I do these walk and talks, there will be a video version of this coming out very soon, so look out for that. But in the meantime, let's hear my interview with Dr. Robert Blythe about the Battle of Trafalgar. Rob, we can't talk about the Battle of Trafalgar without discussing its most famous participant, of course, Lord Nelson. And as we approach here, here's a rather confronting image of Nelson. Tell me, what are we seeing here?
Well, this is not how you expect your naval hero to look. This is Nelson after the Battle of Tenerife. For him, a rare and unexpected defeat. He was shot in the elbow and his right arm was amputated just above the elbow. And at this point in 1797, Nelson thinks his career is over.
Well, quite understandably, from looking at the condition that he's in, retirement would seem to be the next order of business for him.
But his greatest victories are ahead of him. You know, he's going to be at the Nile, he's going to be at Copenhagen, and ultimately he's going to be at Trafalgar. So this seems to capture Nelson perhaps at the lowest point of his career. But as I said, his glory days are actually ahead of him.
Do we know how Nelson felt about having such an intimate portrait painted of him in this condition?
Well, I think it says something about the man that he chose to be depicted like this. And actually, he never disguised his injury. Even in the portrait busts of him, the empty sleeve appears across the bottom of the bust. So it's always there. A constant reminder to Nelson of a defeat, but also, I think, a spur for greater determination in the future.
Well, you're talking about determination, and I see in the cabinet here we've got some letters that Nelson wrote with his left hand because he was right-handed and now forced to use his left hand. But also, what's this implement over here, a combined knife and fork?
Well, this is another element of determination. Nelson didn't want to be in the wardroom in his cabin having to have his meat cut up for him. So a combined knife and fork allowed him to continue to operate as a fellow officer. So it's just another indication of that spark of grit that keeps going in Nelson's mind. And you mention him writing with his left hand. Ironically, the left hand is a boon to historians because he's so much neater with his left hand because he has to constantly practice, whereas his right hand was extremely fluid and rather difficult to read.
What do we know about Nelson as a man? Because he's obviously one of Britain's great heroes, and when you get someone of that level of esteem, often the reality gets a little clouded. What do we actually know about Nelson as a man?
What we know about him is that he is genuinely a great leader of men. He has his fellow officers, his band of brothers, and Nelson has an extremely good personal relationship with these officers. And if you think about battle in the age of sail, the idea of communication between ships is almost non-existent. So once the battle starts, Nelson really has to rely on the initiative and ingenuity of his fellow officers for his plan of action to take place. So Nelson builds up these relationships of trust, of friendship, actually of love, brotherly love with his fellow officers. And it's through that system that he's actually able to become an extremely effective fleet commander.
Rob, it wasn't just about the heroes of the battle, of course. The ordinary sailor was instrumental in the outcome of the Battle of Trafalgar. There's something over here that we've pointed out that I think tells a very interesting story about those ordinary sailors. This little figurine, what are we looking at?
Well, this is a rather unexpected depiction of an ordinary sailor, this sort of flamboyant figure, seemingly almost in fancy dress. But at the time of the Battle of Trafalgar, ordinary sailors didn't have uniform, and that was reserved only for the officers. So in some respects, sailors could wear what they liked. So when they went ashore, they were often in what appeared to be rather outlandish clothing. They also seemed to speak a different language, the slang of being afloat. But on board ship, they had a reputation for being loyal, brave, and actually quite highly skilled. Ashore, they seemed to be drunken, disloyal, debauched, you know, essentially after wine, women, and songs. So you've got this rather split personality for a figure at the time who would have been called Jack Tar, the ordinary sailor.
And as a career, how was life as a sailor, life at sea, how was that esteemed within the community?
Well, people often think that a life at sea was going to be impossibly tough. In fact, you would have to be impressed into the service, in other words, forced to go to sea. But most men were volunteers. They were guaranteed their three meals a day. If their commander was successful in action and caught enemy ships, they would get a share of the prize money. So in actual fact, compared to a life ashore, apart from the enormous dangers of battle, of course, it wasn't as bad as people make out.
And did it tend to be a lifelong career for sailors, assuming they survived battle, of course? Was it something where they would spend decades in the service, or was it a brief part in a broader range of careers?
Some might spend a long time, but of course it depended on the fortunes of war. War meant there was lots of employment for sailors. Peace, on the other hand, meant that you were likely to be made unemployed. The advantage of being in Britain in the 18th century is that you were almost always at war.
It's a wonderful figurine. I mean, where did this come from? And it's obviously made, there's an element of joy there, there's an element of flamboyance, as you said. I mean, why would this figurine have even been constructed in the first place?
Well, what you've got is a representation of the ordinary sailor. And I think it's an idea that it's on these men that Britain's fortunes at war depend. And by fortunes of war, that also means in terms of trade and empire, you know, the sort of whole being of the nation is reliant on, well, this slightly extraordinary figure. So interesting to have him depicted in this colourful and flamboyant way. I mean, I should say you would also have been able to get an unpainted version, okay, which would have calmed him down a little. But this would have been, you know, for a middle-class home, and it would have been there just as a reminder You know, if I'm middle class, if I'm involved in trade, this is who my fortune depends on.
And if that figurine was sitting on a mantelpiece in an 18th century home, would that have been instantly identifiable as a sailor? Or would someone have looked at that and gone, who is this colourful fellow you have here?
He would have been read as a sailor, absolutely, because that figure would have come through in print culture as well. So people would have been familiar with this image of the ordinary sailor. And of course, alongside of him might have been a commemorative of Lord Nelson as well. So you would be playing with rank, but also reflecting the Navy as being key to the nation's defence.
You used the word unexpected when we approached this figurine, and we're here surrounded by cannons and guns and the artefacts of war. As a curator, what does it mean to you to have this unexpected object in the collection?
Well, I think it acts as a counterpoint to how we often perceive the ordinary sailor to be. I mean, clearly, he's having fun. I mean, this isn't a doleful figure by any stretch of the imagination, nor does it seem to be a figure completely oppressed by naval discipline and the harshness of life afloat. So I think there's genuine joy in that figure.
In the age of sail, Rob, these battles were huge and horrific in so many ways. We're here in front of a display of different types of shot that would be fired from cannons during one of these epic naval battles. Just talk me through it, because I'm surprised by the range of different objects that could be propelled out of a cannon. Talk us through how this type of warfare unfolded.
So, I mean, obviously the basic form of shot is the standard round cannonball of various sizes depending on the gun it's being fired from. And the idea there was essentially to smash against the wooden walls of the ship and literally pound that ship into submission. So if you imagine a cannonball hitting the side of a ship, it will release splinters on the other side and they can travel through the gun deck, causing terrific loss of life. So that's one particular type of weapon.
Because it's important to point out here as well, the objective here wasn't to sink the enemy ships, was it? It was to capture them. So they didn't want to send them to the bottom of the ocean. They wanted to disable them, and particularly they wanted to kill the crews so they could take over the ship.
Which means that a cannonball might not always be your best weapon. So what we've got at the end is what's called bar shot. And this would be fired out of the gun and would spin. And this is very good for taking out rigging and spars. So what you can do is essentially disable the ship's propulsion, its sails, which means it cannot get away from the battle. So it will become a sitting duck. Then you might want to get rid of the crew on deck. Let's say you're going to try and board the ship. But what we've got here is what's called tier or canister shot. So essentially it will be fired at the deck and will release multiple bits of shot down onto the deck. So it's essentially the cannon equivalent of a machine gun, for want of a better term. And then finally, you might want to disable the ship and its rigging by fire, so you could put out hot shot. So this would be heated shot, red hot shot, that you would fire at the ship. And ideally, what you would want is for that, of course, to come in contact with gunpowder on board the enemy ship. And that really will be the end of the battle for that vessel. So a huge variety. Now, in the specifics of Trafalgar, Nelson's flagship, the Victory, gets caught into an extremely close encounter with a French warship called the Redoutable. And essentially, they've almost become joined together in the rigging. So the cannon are firing at you just a few metres across at each other. So bang, bang, you know. And here the skills of the British sailors tell, because they're actually able to fire more quickly than the French. So that training, that bravery, that skill begins to tell. But the problem of two ships so close together is that it also gives the opportunity for some sniper fire as well. And that certainly takes us to a key point in the Battle of Trafalgar.
Just looking at these items, Rob, it's like all phases of war that I've studied, there's great ingenuity. This is actually quite clever. These are clever solutions to problems of how to disable and capture an enemy ship. But at the same time, it's horrific. We're talking about the injuries these would do to human beings. But here they are presented in quite an abstract way, quite a sterile way. How do you feel, again, in the museum? How do you, particularly with young people, how do you bridge that gap between here are items of war and here's the effects these had on human beings?
Well, I mean, I think visitors, young visitors in particular, are fascinated by, as it were, instruments of destruction. And I think they see the sort of middle part, you know, the idea of loading the gun, firing the gun. There's very little that explores the actual impact of this sort of warfare. These are, to use the term, blunt weapons. They're not precision weapons by any sense. They're actually designed to cause the maximum impact for the minimum amount of punch. So the injuries that could be caused were absolutely horrendous. And of course, the onboard facilities for dealing with those injuries are possibly even more horrific than the instruments of destruction themselves. So you're really talking about very basic surgery, you know, no anaesthetic, no antiseptic, no antibiotic. So a really nasty affair.
Do modern visitors understand when they look at these things? Do they understand the ramifications of using these types of weapons in warfare, or are they just simply abstract objects that tell an interesting historical story?
I think for most visitors, they remain in the abstract. I think what's difficult to imagine is the impact of a cannonball when you are on the gun deck of a ship. You know, low ceiling, wood all around, and you are being pounded by these great big lumps of iron. I mean, the noise, the smoke, the danger would have been extraordinary.
I guess that's why the great work of yourself and the other curators at the museum is so important to keep these stories alive. It's quite a wonderful display.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's some really wonderful examples of naval uniforms in the collection. This one's pretty spectacular. Rob, just talk us through what we're looking at here. The officers obviously wore coats like this one. Tell us a little bit about this type of naval coat.
So the rank of each officer was made clear by the uniform. So whether you had various bits at the cuff, how many buttons you had, whether you had epaulettes or not. So this is a vice admiral's undress uniform. So the one immediately below full dress. So in other words, this is an everyday working uniform for a commanding officer.
And what do the badges on the breast represent?
So this indicates that he's been given various awards and honours. These are the sort of fabric equivalent of a medal. So if he were in his full dress uniform, various medals would be worn. Because this is undress, he's just got the fabric equivalent pinned to his chest. This is showing off a little.
Well, it strikes me as interesting because this is a battle-worn uniform, and we know that, of course, because this is Nelson's jacket that he was wearing when he was wounded during the Battle of Trafalgar. I mean, quite extraordinary. I have no idea he would have been wearing, as you say, it's an undress uniform, but it still appears fairly fairly dramatic and is making a statement.
Yes, and of course the telltale sign is on the shoulder, where you can see the hole left by the fatal musket ball. I mean, essentially, we're at about 1:15 in the afternoon at Trafalgar. Nelson is on the quarter deck, trying to see how the battle is going, making his assessment, issuing orders, and then suddenly, you know, amongst all of the shot that's ringing out, another one rings out, and this time it captures Nelson in the left shoulder from high in the rigging. So it passes down through Nelson's shoulder, through his lung, and lodges in the base of his spine. Nelson is immediately paralysed and falls to the deck and indicates to his flag captain, Thomas Masterman Hardy, who's standing next to him, you know, essentially, they've got me. I'm done for. And then Nelson is very discreetly taken below deck so that as few people as possible can see that he has fallen. And he's actually taken down to something called the orlop deck, which is where the sergeant is. So this is actually below the waterline of the ship. And he sees the sergeant, Beatty, and Beatty says, "There's nothing I can do for you, my lord." Essentially, Nelson is going to die. So he's made comfortable. The uniform jacket is removed and tucked to one side. And Nelson remains lucid for a number of hours. So at the beginning, he's able to hear information from the deck and continue to issue orders as he sees fit. Then he begins to fall in and out of consciousness. He's essentially drowning in his own blood. And then finally, of course, he's able to issue a series of last words. You know, "Thank God I've done my duty. You know, kiss me, Hardy." You know, a final bit of affection from a fellow officer. And of course, hoping that his mistress, Emma Hamilton, will be looked after. And then he dies. And his body is then put in a barrel of French brandy.
So he was pickled as his final...
pickled, yeah.
The final treatment of him. As I look at this, Rob, I think to myself, this is a fairly extravagant piece of clothing. And I've heard stories from, for example, the First and Second World Wars about officers actually donning enlisted men's clothing and taking off all their marks of rank so that they didn't make themselves targets for snipers. Did wearing this coat while striding around the deck of a ship make Nelson an easy target for his enemies?
Well, it may have made him a target, but this is his uniform. This is what he was expected to wear in battle. So essentially, he is marking himself out principally to members of his own crew that he is the officer in command. Now, it has long been thought that the French marksman probably got a lucky shot. You have to imagine that you're on the swaying, up in the rigging, swaying about at sea. But a television programme a few years ago had a man way up in a cherry picker swaying about trying to hit a dummy wearing a similar uniform and actually got him in the shoulder. So it may have been luck, it may actually have been decent marksmanship. And clearly wearing this would have identified him as an officer. But then of course there would have been many officers on the deck wearing similar style of clothing. But whether it was the result, you know, wearing this was the result of him getting shot, I don't know. But, I mean, you can see, you know, the bullet hole, the fact that part of his epaulette has gone, you know. Yeah.
It was obviously a devastating shot, but this was what the French marksmen were trained to do. That was why they were up in the rigging. They were trained that when the ships get close together, look for the officers and pick them off.
Absolutely.
So this was not an unusual turn of events during a battle.
No, this is essentially a legitimate part of warfare. What you're trying to do is disrupt the chain of command and hope that that might give you an advantage. In the case of the Battle of Trafalgar, ultimately it didn't.
I can't actually believe I'm looking at this. This is what, you know, in terms of, this is one of the most historic items you could ever cast your eyes on. I mean, is this the pride of the entire collection, especially as it relates to Nelson?
I think this probably is the ultimate Nelson relic. I mean, you know, his uniform coat from Trafalgar, bearing the scars of battle and the shot that killed him. I can't think of anything that would quite get close to that.
It's wonderful how items can tell a story, the combination of an artefact and the history that we know coming together in an item like this to tell just such an important story.
Yeah, but they really do combine in this object.
It's in extraordinarily good condition, Rob, for an article of clothing that is more than two centuries old, and especially one that is so esteemed by the people of Britain. You'd think this would be knocked around and faded and in much worse condition than it is. I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
Well, I mean, the coat is principally made of a heavy wool fabric with a silk lining. The silk lining is the one that causes us, as it were, the most trouble, because silk tends to get very fragile. But amazingly, for an object that's actually been on public display essentially for 150 years, the blue wool fabric has faded very, very little. So it's a testament, I think, to, you know, the quality of Nelson's tailors and the quality of the weavers that this material has survived for so long. And, I mean, it's hard to imagine this object not being on display. You know, and I'm certain my colleagues in conservation would love to rest this object in a dark storeroom for several decades. But really, it has iconic status and is standing up to the task.
After his victories and his shocking death, Nelson was obviously a hero to the people of Britain. Talk to me a little bit, Rob, about how the people of Britain reacted to the death of Nelson and how they commemorated him in years that would come.
Well, you've got mixed emotions because, of course, two pieces of news arrive at the same time. The first and foremost is that Britain has secured victory at the Battle of Trafalgar, a victory of annihilation, as Nelson had wanted. But then, of course, that's tinged because Britain's sort of pop star admiral, Lord Nelson, has been killed in battle. So Nelson's body returns to Britain. It lies in state in Greenwich and then is taken upriver to Whitehall, and then a great state funeral takes place from Whitehall to St Paul's Cathedral. Nelson's body has arrived at St Paul's before the last part of the procession has left Whitehall. So this is a huge state occasion. And there is one moment of extraordinary drama during the funeral service, because ordinary sailors from HMS Victory take part, and their role is to fold the Union flag from Victory, put it on top of Nelson's coffin, and then the coffin will descend into the crypt. But at that very moment, they break rank and they actually begin tearing up the Union flag because they want a memento of Nelson. Ordinary sailors don't get a battle medal at that stage. So they want this memento. They want part of the flag, which seems an extraordinary thing to do. But of course, I did say that they were disloyal on land as opposed to being afloat. But of course, everyone wants a Nelson commemorative in the aftermath of Trafalgar. And as this case shows, and this, I have to say, is not even the tip of the iceberg of what we have in terms of Nelson commemoratives, you get a Nelson commemorative for every pocket, whether you be working class to aristocratic, and for every form of taste. And from simple Staffordshire figures that could be on almost anyone's mantelpiece, to extraordinary things like a crocus bulb planter. So different tastes, different pockets, all represented. And these commemoratives have extraordinary longevity. Not only do people hold on to the originals, but when Trafalgar Square was laid out with Nelson's column in the 1840s. All of this stuff was reissued. When it's the centenary of the Battle of Trafalgar in 1905, a huge amount of this stuff is reissued. And bless them, in 2005, for the bicentenary, some of this stuff is reissued again. So Nelson commemoratives keep giving.
Was there a 2005 version of the grandfather clock that came out?
I have no doubt that there was. All I can say is we didn't collect one, but yeah.
Where does this clock date from? Because that's probably the most extraordinary centrepiece of the collection.
Well, essentially, I mean, this will be early 19th century, and you can see above the dial is the figure of the death of Nelson. Essentially the same figure that's represented in the cheap Staffordshire ware. Now, not everyone who can afford this clock, you know, would necessarily have the Staffordshire, but you know, there they are. It's the same figure. So this image of him falling on the deck becomes, you know, almost universal. And it's almost a sort of Christ-like figure. This is almost the body of Christ descending from the cross. So it's really drawing back on earlier art forms. So the whole sort of mythologization of Nelson, his almost godlike status coming through in these commemoratives.
Just share with me, Robert, some of the other items in here that really speak to you about Nelson and this story of commemoration.
Well, as I say, the range of things, they principally focus on the Battle of Trafalgar. We've got, for example, here a little toy for a child, which is of the funeral procession. Now, it seems very strange to have a child play with a funeral procession, but that was the toy. You then get very high-end materials, so, you know, chinoiserie-style vases, again, with battle scenes on, the simple portrait bust that would appear over and over again. And it's across materials as well. So we've got ceramics, we've got glass, we've got little enamel patch boxes, either pill cases or a lady's snuff box, perhaps, again with Nelson on. So even the most simple day-to-day functions could carry a commemorative purpose. So really quite extraordinary. I mean, the equivalent today, I suppose, would be royal commemorative ware, where you can get something for, you know, a coronation or a marriage that spans a whole range of media. But this is for an admiral, a naval commander. So this is Turner's famous Battle of Trafalgar painting, the largest painting he ever did, and a royal commission for George IV, initially displayed at St. James's Palace. So part of a huge suite of works of art celebrating British victory.
It certainly does that. It's a dramatic piece of art, to say the least.
Yeah. I mean, what Turner has done is stitched together several stages of the battle to produce a single dramatic scene. And Turner was keen to get things as accurate as he could. He spoke to veterans, read accounts of the battle, but when it was displayed to the public for the first time, it was immediately controversial. You know, officers began saying, well, victory didn't look like that at the battle. You've made victory look like a terrace of houses, one of them is said to have reported. So almost at once, the painting attached a certain controversy as being, you know, let's say, more a work of art than a celebration of victory at Trafalgar.
And I noticed, Rob, the the spread of humanity in front of the ship here. It's unexpected to see people depicted in the foreground of a naval painting. What's Turner trying to tell us here?
Well, Turner is wanting you to focus initially not on this grand battle scene behind, but on the humanity, the suffering and heroism of the ordinary sailor. So this is literally a bottom-up view of the Battle of Trafalgar, with the sailor at the foreground, and then the big dramatic heroism of the battle proper pushed slightly back into this sort of smoky, hazy middle ground.
And I assume this is Nelson's famous signal?
England expects that every man shall do his duty. So, you know, it's imbued with a sort of patriotic sentiment. You see the Union flag in the bottom. Into the sea at the front is Nelson's motto as well. So the whole thing imbued with a sense of victory, a sense of heroism, and ultimately, as perhaps indicated by the falling foremast of victory, one of loss as well.
Rob, I've heard many different interpretations about what this painting actually represents, what all the elements mean. What do you see when you look at this painting?
Well, I mean, obviously, apart from humanity being in the foreground, you've got victory centre stage, and the name says it all. But HMS Victory can represent Nelson himself, centre stage in the battle. It may also embody the broader experience of the Royal Navy in the conflict, but victory may also be the embodiment of the British state, which has emerged from these long, long wars with France, victorious at the end. So multiple layers of meaning can be attached to the painting. And then, of course, there are doubtless things that are not entirely familiar to us that Turner would have noted when he was composing the image. So undeniably, a complex work of art.
Is this the most important item in the museum that tells the story of the Battle of Trafalgar?
Well, unlike Nelson's coat, this is not an eyewitness account. So I would favour the coat, but as a post-Trafalgar interpretation of the battle, this is clearly one of the key items.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Want to get smarter about investing? Then tune in to the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, home of American Funds Distributors, Inc., one of the world's leading asset managers. Each week, we bring you stock market outlooks, macroeconomic updates, and investment strategies that can help you succeed. Learn from portfolio managers with decades of experience about how they navigate uncertain markets. Prepare to be engaged, enlightened, and entertained by listening to the Capital Ideas podcast today.